Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's speech today in a small town in Kansas that was the site of a famous speech by Theodore Roosevelt in 1910. James Kloppenberg, Professor of History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University, joins us. He's the author of a new book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Tradition. We will discuss the populist tone the President is now adopting, asking for a fair shot and a fair share, and whether Obama will follow Teddy Roosevelt's example and go after the big monopolies and powerful interests now defined as the 1%. Then Nina Khrushcheva, the granddaughter of a former Soviet leader, joins us to discuss the Russian elections and the demonstrations that followed them. She is just back from Moscow, and we'll gauge the level of disgust and fatigue the Russian people have for the revolving door leadership of Putin and Medvedev, whose United Russia party is widely reported to have engaged in massive fraud, prompting Secretary of State Clinton to condemn the elections and call for a full investigation. Then finally, we'll be joined by two activists involved in the Occupy Our Homes movement who tried to prevent the eviction of a homeowner and support the reoccupation of a foreclosed home by its previous owner today in nearby Southgate and Riverside. Peggy Mears, a community organizer with ACE, the Alliance for Californians for Community Empowerment, spearheaded one of the actions, and Chase Golding, one of the organizers of Occupy LA, who was involved in the other action, will address how the Occupy movement is now engaged in occupying foreclosed homes. Joining us now is James Kloppenberg, who's the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Uncertain Victory, Social Democracy and Progressism in Europe and American Thought, 1870 to 1920, The Virtues of Liberalism, A Companion to American Thought, and his new book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kloppenberg.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And today the president declared the middle class in jeopardy and outlined a populist economic vision calling for a fair shot and a fair share. And clearly he was channeling, shall we say, President Theodore Roosevelt, since he was in the same place where Roosevelt gave a speech in 1910 where he called for a square deal for regular Americans. Do you think this is...
It's a good point, and he is quite clearly trying to hearken back to a very progressive Republican president. When Roosevelt ran in 1912, he ran as a third-party candidate, as the Progressive Party candidate, but he had served indeed as president as a Republican. And in calling for a square deal, he was advancing the cause of most of the reformers in the multifaceted movement that was called progressivism. And I think what President Obama is trying to do is to rekindle that progressive spirit.
Well, Roosevelt went further, I think, in that particular speech that the president is echoing. He said the fight for progress was a conflict between the men who possess more than they have earned and the men who have earned more than they possess. Pretty powerful, simple framing, I'd say.
It is powerful, and it not only harkens back, Obama's speech not only harkens back to Teddy Roosevelt, it harkens back further than that to Abraham Lincoln. People sometimes forget today that language of earned income was the language of most Americans from the 18th century through the 19th century and into the 20th century. The notion that income that is earned from other sources is somehow legitimate is a fairly recent phenomenon in American history, and the notion that attacking that unearned wealth is somehow un-American or populist or a version of class warfare strikes most historians as almost comic, because this has been the central line of American thought on politics and economics for a very long time.
Well, of course, Theodore Roosevelt was an accidental president, and in many ways, comparisons have been made to the Gilded Age, where McKinley represented the plutocrats against William Jennings Bryan, who were then the populists. And of course, the irony was in those days, populism amongst the rural poor and the urban poor was in many ways reposed in religion. In other words, you had a religious left back then.
You did, and we've had a religious left in America ever up until very recently. I mean, that was one of the striking things about reform in America for much of our history, that the most radical people economically have been, in many cases, the most fervently Christian, and the notion that somehow inequality has become the ideology of American Christians, again, strikes historians as a very peculiar development, because it's certainly not the way things played out in the 19th or the first half of the 20th century.
So, James Kloppenberg, do you believe that the president can put history back in its rightful place and revive this? I take it you consider this a dormant movement?
Well, I wouldn't even call it dormant. I think it's the position that he took in 2008. In fact, it's the position that he took in the second of his two books, The Audacity of Hope. And anyone who has read that book will recognize the speech today as coming straight out of Obama's analysis of American history and American politics in that very fine book. So I think he is simply returning to the strategies that he adopted that got him elected to the Senate from Illinois and that he took with him to Washington. I think since his election to the presidency, he's tried very hard to work with the Republican Party and has tried to be a compromiser, a conciliator, someone who could find common ground, because that's the way he thinks democracy should work. And the Republicans have demonstrated now through all of his presidency that they don't see it that way, that they would prefer to be obstructionists. So I think he has learned his lesson, and my sense is that this is the opening speech of the 2012 presidential campaign.
So, James Kloppenberg, is that to say then that this forthcoming election, you know, we've got a whole year plus to go, but could it be therefore framed around a kind of religious left and a religious right? There's no question that the religious right has tremendous power within the Republican Party, and particularly in the nominating process. They control the Iowa caucus effectively, and as you can see, most of the candidates are kowtowing to them. With the exception of Romney, who's a Mormon and is therefore not particularly welcomed by the religious right. So if they can have a litmus test on that side, why not the president, in effect, use the real ammunition in the Bible? Because after all, the prophet Jesus ministered to the poor. He didn't carry an AK-47, he didn't hate homosexuals, and he didn't go on television asking for money.
Exactly so. You're quite right, and this tradition of what is called the social gospel in America has had a long and distinguished history, and Obama himself has aligned himself with that tradition that originates in the late 19th century and gathers momentum up to the middle of the 20th century. And as far as he's concerned, I think the way you put it is exactly right, that this is a tradition that historically sided with the disfranchised. It sided with the poor and the downtrodden. And I think what he wants to do is to remind American Christians that this is a gospel of benevolence that they claim to believe in and not a gospel of greed and selfishness. And I think calling Americans back to that older reading of the gospel is, from my perspective, a very strong argument for him to make. Again, this is something he's been committed to for a very long time. It comes through both in his autobiography and in his second book, and it's an understanding of Christianity that I think has very deep roots, as you understand, and I think what he's trying to do is just to remind people of that.
Again, I'm speaking with James Kloppenberg, who is professor of American history and chair of the history department at Harvard University and author of the new book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. Well, clearly, I don't know how religious Theodore Roosevelt was, but he sure shook up the big trusts. I referred to him earlier as a sort of accidental precedent, in as much as McKinley was assassinated, and he was clearly put on the ticket to balance out the plutocrats' dominance of the party at that time. I take it he took a lot of people by surprise. What more can the president learn from Theodore Roosevelt in terms of mimicking him?
Well, I'm not sure that there's a whole lot more for him to learn, because the trajectory of their two careers is so different. I think the conception that there is nothing anti or un-American about calling for greater equality and calling for a square deal, as Roosevelt did, is a theme that President Obama will do well to recover. I think that the Republicans have been arguing for quite a while that there's somehow something illegitimate about this call for equality. And I think it's striking in the audacity of hope that President Obama notes that when Thomas Jefferson came back from writing the Declaration of Independence, the first thing he did when he got home to Virginia was to file legislation to end the two practices that had preserved great wealth in Europe, primogeniture and entail. These were the methods by which European aristocrats maintained their fortunes. And America began with an assault on that notion of passing down fortunes from one generation to another. So the idea that there is something un-American about a challenge to inequality that has become stifling, which is what we face in our own day, is a fantasy. It's a myth. And I think the president knows enough about American history to make that clear. So when self-styled historians such as Newt Gingrich spin out their fantasies about American history, I think this is a president who actually has the goods, who will be able to call them on it and offer facts rather than fantasies of American history.
So, James Kloppenberg, do you think the president was clever in choosing the site, clearly aimed at echoing Theodore Roosevelt, and choosing a lot of the language that Roosevelt gave in 1910 about inequality being the defining issue of our time? And you know, of course, that the Republicans have already been accusing him of being a socialist, and at least some of them are running and anti-American and not even an American. We know all of the poisonous stuff that's been said, but clearly they've been trying to tie him to the Occupy movement that the world's highest paid historian Newt Gingrich refers to as a bunch of people who need a bath. He I think deftly tied himself to that movement via Roosevelt, didn't he?
Well, I think what he's trying to do is to call attention to the same issue that has been animating most of the occupiers, which is the issue of increasing inequality in America. And I don't see that as an issue that is the issue of the occupiers alone. That's an issue that many people in the Democratic Party have been calling attention to for a very long time. In the 1912 election, it was not only Theodore Roosevelt who was contesting that, but also his successor, William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson. And in that election in 1912, one could argue that all of the major candidates had gotten on board with this program of graduated income tax, of economic regulation, of minimum wage, an eight-hour day, which were innovations at the time. And I think that that was the moment when the old notions of laissez-faire really did come to an end, and that was the moment in which every party had embraced the idea of progressive politics and progressive economics. So I think what the president is trying to do, and you may be right that this is a shrewd move on his part, is to remind Republicans that their own party has in its background moderates who were not opposed to a graduated income tax, who were not opposed to economic regulation, and who believed that inequality was a serious problem for everyone in the United States, not just something that appealed to the great unwashed, as the Republican Party candidates this year are trying to pretend it is.
Well, it's relatively recently, President Eisenhower, a Republican, in his day, the wealthiest Americans paid 92% in income tax. Now they pay 35%, and the Republicans are offering them less.
Right. No, it's true.
Times have changed.
And, President Obama made the point in his speech today that he's not even talking about returning to those days of 80 and 90% marginal tax rates at the very top. He's talking only about returning to the Clinton years when the top marginal tax rate was 39%. And I think as the year unfolds, he will remind the American people that the years of the greatest economic growth in the United States were the years from the New Deal up through 1980, when tax rates were much higher than they are today. And again, the mythology that somehow high taxes mean no economic growth and low taxes mean great economic growth is simply not borne out by the facts. We had much greater economic growth during those years. We even had much greater economic growth during the Clinton years than we've had since the Bush tax cuts. And the notion that we should go back to a situation that has been proven not to work for the vast majority of Americans, so that the situation that worked very, very well for the top 1 or 2% can continue as it did during the Bush years, is to me an extraordinarily anti-American ideology. And yet the challenge to that ideology is being called un-American. And I think what the president is trying to do is to remind his listeners that this tradition of challenging inequality is as old as the United States, and it has distinguished champions as they go back as far as Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, and include Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt, as well as Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, the president in his speech specifically took aim at the Republicans, saying that their philosophy is that we're better off when everyone is left to fend for themselves and play by their own rules. Now, that it clearly, is, if anything, that is the philosophy of Ayn Rand, who railed against altruism and praised the virtues of selfishness. I don't think Ayn Rand is an American tradition.
No, and I think when someone like Ron Paul tries to pretend that she is and that libertarianism is the genuine American gospel, there's very little in American history that can be offered as evidence of that claim. To the contrary, the progressive income tax, the graduated income tax, has been the law of the land for more than a century. It's been in some states for more than a century. It's been in the United States as a nation since the First World War. And I think until very recently, no one questioned the legitimacy of it. President Obama, I think, did well today to invoke the words of the former Intel CEO, who pointed out, as a lot of people have pointed out in the last century, that those who earned the most owe the most to those who made it possible for them to amass those great fortunes. And again, it's fairly recent for people to deny that interdependence and to claim that somehow it's all theirs because they have no one to they have no debts to anyone for having amassed such fortunes. That's been a position of a tiny minority of people for over a century in the United States. And that transformation that occurred in the 1890s, in which people began to clamor for a graduated income tax because they realized that the sources of wealth were the collective contributions of all persons in the society, not just of a handful of persons, is an ideology that has much deeper roots than this gospel of selfishness and greed that we've been hearing spouted from the Republican candidates this time.
And in terms of the Occupy movement, the president said throughout the country it sparked protests and political movements from the Tea Party to the people who've been occupying the streets of New York and other cities. Again, I think cleverly tying the Tea Party in with the Occupy movement. Just in closing, what's your sense of how much the Occupy movement is going to translate into a political movement, particularly in terms of electoral politics, James Kloppenberg?
It's very hard to say. It's the case that very successful social protest movements begin in just the inchoate way that the Occupy movement is beginning, but it's also the case that unsuccessful social protest movements begin the same way. I think it's too early to say. I think by calling attention to the issue of inequality, they've helped advance the progressive cause by forcing people to confront this problem. And to that extent, I think they might provide impetus toward a renewed progressive reform movement, and I think that President Obama could ride that sentiment to re-election in the White House. But unless the movement broadens itself and translates into a campaign to elect a Democratic Congress, it won't necessarily make as much difference as we might think it would, because we discovered from 2010 until the present that if the president does not have majorities in the House and the Senate, it's very difficult to get anything done. So no matter how progressive his own agenda might be, and anyone who's read his books knows that he is indeed a progressive, not a radical, but a moderate progressive, someone who would like to move one step at a time toward a more egalitarian culture. Unless he has the support of a strong Congress, as Franklin Roosevelt had in the 1930s and 40s, as Lyndon Johnson had in the 1960s, it's very difficult for a progressive party, for a progressive president to get much done. So it's important to call attention to these issues. It's important for the president to do everything he can to assure his reelection. But in the absence of a Democratic Congress, all of that will not mean as much as it might otherwise.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, James Kloppenberg.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Kloppenberg, who's the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Uncertain Victory, Social Democracy and Progressivism in European and American Thought, 1870 to 1920, The Virtues of Liberalism, A Companion to American Thought, and his new book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking about the Russian elections and the demonstrations that followed.
Fresh-faced police, they won't even know what to hit them when they lift their Roman shades and the people's sun comes pouring in on a brand new day.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing if you have no rights. Let race this ignorance be...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and joining us now is Nina Kusheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow of the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, Association of Newspapers Around the World. She served as a deputy editor for the East European Constitutional Review at NYU School of Law and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics, and is currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kusheva.
Yeah.
And Nina, you're just back from Moscow, and of course the elections just took place, followed by fairly substantial demonstrations. Did that surprise you?
Not really. I mean, it has been brewing for the last year or so. Since 2010, Russians have started organizing and getting to the streets in very small numbers comparing to other countries, so in the hundreds. And actually, when I was in Moscow about a week ago, there was a demonstration against, right pre-election sort of against Putin and his party, United Russia. And the debate was whether it's going to be 500 or whether it was 500 or 1,000. So it's very heartening to know that yesterday there was a demonstration and protests. Over 10,000 people came to the streets.
So what is the constituency that's left? If obviously his Putin's United Russia Party didn't win the 50% votes, which of course is a good thing in the sense that you actually have a real parliament, not a rubber stamp. I mean, so he's down from the 64% of 4 years ago. But he's been doing this kind of revolving door with Medvedev, and he was recently booed and jeered at a martial arts bout. How anecdotal is it? I mean, where does his support remain? Because my understanding is, somewhat depressingly, is that the young people under 25 seem to be the most loyal to the regime. Is that your understanding?
Yeah. I mean, some of them, quite a lot of them, actually, the young below 25, are basically bought by the Putin regime. I mean, there's the Nasha movement, and there's a lot of other patriotic movements that the government supports and pays them for their loyalty. So I wouldn't really be convinced that they're genuinely, these are the people that are very loyal to Putin. Some of them are. Some of them still kind of in the mode of 2000, you know, from 2000 to 2010, that he's a guarantor of a strong and strong and stable nation. But that has waned away. I mean, that whole conviction, because corruption is very rampant. And in fact, most of the corrupt officials of the United Russia Party Representative Police is incredibly, incredibly corrupt. So there is some support going on, just because there is no really, over the many opposition groups and many opposition leaders, there's really nobody who the Russians believe can step in and actually lead the country to something better, which I'm not even sure the Russians know what better is, in the sense that what they want is that so the police wouldn't harass them, but not necessarily that they would have more freedoms the way it's usually understood. Or, for example, oh, let's have free press or free TV. I don't know how much that is a priority. So that contradiction between Putin's argument of a stable nation and whatever Russians see in the streets, which the courts are corrupt, police is corrupt, so all these things that really affect very ordinary Russians. But, you know, I don't know if it's not, you said that it's not going to be a rubber stamp parliament. I'm not really sure, because the opposition parties that got in, I mean, they're arguing opposition, but they've been in the parliament before, and not that they were really opposing United Russia that much. So I think the vote of no confidence is that even with remarkably rigged elections, remarkably stuffed bulletins, remarkably completely harassed monitors or officials who were supposed to oversee that the elections were fair, he still was unable to get even 50%. So that is a stunning blow to the regime.
So Nina Khrushcheva, looking forward to the presidential elections, Boris Nemtsov, the opposition founder of the People's Freedom Party, he's arguing, and he's trying to create a political party under the slogan "None of the Above," the goal of which is to bring the number of voters rejecting all candidates to 40%. And of course, if that happens under the Constitution, the elections will have to be declared invalid. What is there? Is there some traction for his ideas in the electorate?
Well, there is some traction. I mean, all these ideas sort of have some supporters. But the reason I say why I think this is not a viable alternative, not that there is a viable alternative altogether, is that if they're going to rig the election, it's irrelevant that we mark all of the above. And reject all of the above, because the bulletins are going to come in with Putin marked as president. So I think that is not, because the elections are such a farce. I don't think that even we should be even discussing how we are going to vote or not vote. I think the solution, as it was after the elections, 10,000 people went to the street. When the cortege of Putin or his flunkies are blocking Moscow traffic for 6 hours, what are we doing sitting in our cars? Get out of the car, block the traffic. So really do something to show the regime that it's invalid, that we don't want it, we don't like it. But, you know, discussing how we are going to pretend that the elections are fair. They're not fair. They're not going to be fair. So it's almost irrelevant what we do during the elections, I mean.
Again, I'm speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, professor of the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's the author of a new book, which she's working on, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. But it would seem that there are two kind of Russias in a way, the Russia of the brainwashed to the Russians watching state TV and the Russians on the internet. And apparently there's night and day in terms of information. What's your sense of how much the people who are informing themselves via the internet are a growing force?
Well, I mean, it seems like it was a bit growing force, and I don't know, because Russians are generally cynical. They're usually waiting for, very rarely the revolutions happen there, and they happen there horrible, bloody, and so the Russians are generally afraid of those, and therefore they tend to be complacent for very, very long time. So the internet was like Russian literature before. It was a venting device rather than really call for protests and opposition. And I think it really changed in the last 2 weeks. I think it started changing very radically since September, when on the 24th, Putin announced that he's going to become new president and turn Medvedev into his prime minister. And I think that really was such a slap in everybody's face. I think Putin made, I don't know whoever advised him, and actually we don't know who advises him, made an amazing, remarkably bad strategic mistake. They should have kept it very close to the vest until the last minute. And that's when the public would not have had enough time to organize. But now, as of September, you know, it really became clear that it is such a sham of a president, it's a sham of a prime minister, it's a sham of a state. And so the internet was gaining momentum, although before it was, as I said, a venting device more than anything else. And in fact, on the 4th, when the elections happened, just last Sunday, and there was a call, Nemtsov, in fact, called for a protest, a big protest on the 5th on Monday. A lot of internet social media postings were, are we going to vent on the online, or are we actually physically going to go to the protest? And it does seem that people actually produce bodies rather than just posting witty comments on online.
Well, I brought it up, Nina, because Russia has the highest penetration of internet in the world. And we were talking a minute ago about the young people who seem to be the most loyal, those that belong to NASHI, the United Russia's Youth Party. This is a generation, of course, that grew up watching Putin's TV networks, and they're cynical, and I guess they're looking to buy patronage and protection. But my understanding is that unless the oil stays up, and it's quite possible, there may be an attack on Iran, which would, of course, benefit Putin. But that seems to be the anchors of his regime, oil prices and the ability to brainwash via television. But he can't, the myth of upward social mobility that his young supporters are buying into, that's a myth, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what became, as of 2010, it really became very clear that it's a myth, because when he talks about stability, it really is stagnation. There's no upward mobility. There's always the same message. And my theory also is that in the last year or so, he also lost that image of a strong man that was so welcomed by all Russians, in fact, of all generations, because he was sort of a strong man who's going to lead Russia into the great future versus the decaying that West. And faltering United States and whatnot. And he became too vain for that. I mean, there were too many pictures of him shirtless. There were too many incidents of him kissing dolphins or, I don't know, saving tigers or journalists or salvaging names. Anyway, it's every week. And also he had a facelift last year, and there was a whole debate, is it Botox, is it the facelift? He became very vain. He became Berlusconi, so to speak. And I think for a strong man ruler, you can't be Berlusconi. I mean, you can afford Berlusconi in Italy, but you really cannot afford Berlusconi in Russia of 9 time zones where it's dark and cold and natural resources run the game. And I think that's another incredibly bad mistake that was made by his PR people and himself.
So, Nina Khrushcheva, the other, I'm not surprised, I suppose, but the other other report that comes out of the elections is that the communists seem to be the main beneficiaries. They've doubled their vote to around 20%. I find it sort of interesting in a way that because, you know, one's reminded of, because of the charges of fraud and ballot stuffing involved in this election that prompted the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to suggest that the election should be investigated, that they're rife with fraud. I'm reminded of Stalin's adage, you know, it's not a question of who votes, but who counts the votes. But it seems to me that given you've got this KGB incorporated kind of government run by Putin and the KGB type seem to be sort of protecting the boss from the people, I guess. It sort of, in a way, shows, doesn't it, that repression is, you know, in the West, they've always associated repression with communism, but now you have capitalist repression, right? Not unlike what they have in China.
Well, I mean, I think it's an incredible irony and just shows you how Russia is running in circles, has been running in circles throughout history. So it's despotism, reforms, and coming back to despotism. I actually find it almost inconceivable that the communists are the second popular party after 75 years of communism. And, you know, talking about those leaders who run the communist party, like Gennady Zyuganov, talking about people who have not reformed. So we are trading. I mean, that is mind-boggling. It's just basically one option is worse than another. There's no good option. Is that we're trading KGB Putin to the communist Zyuganov. I mean, that really tells you that Russia is not only in a crossroad, but basically in a foundation pit.
Well, what about the rest in between United Russia and the communists? The coalitions of the endangered species of liberals and social democrats.
Well, I mean, yeah, but we also have to remember that most of those liberals are the ones that were leftovers of the Yeltsin regime, and not that they were performing brilliantly then. So there's really not much choice going on because the liberals are heavily mistrusted. I mean, I think the reason now the 10,000 people that came out, they didn't come out because the liberals called them, because they were just really, really insulted by Putin, who went really too far in completely disrespecting his nation, not because Nemtsov called them. So, I mean, Nemtsov announced the meeting, but, you know, not that Nemtsov is particularly greatly respected or another opposition leader, Mikhail Kasyanov, who was the prime minister under Yeltsin and slight bit under Putin, and his nickname was Misha 2%, so you can make any deal with him.
Right.
2% cutoff. So that is another problem, is that, and there is, you know, other people like Milov, for example, who are slightly newer, fresh opposition. But these were the people that until a year ago were arguing that Medvedev is the greatest solution for Russia. I mean, talking about completely...
drinking the Kool-Aid, right.
President.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, the choices, I mean, ultimately the choice, as far as people are concerned, at least Putin saying he's stable. But I honestly think that we just want the Putin that we like. We don't want the Putin that is sort of Berlusconi-like. That is an insult to the strong man of Siberia or something like that. The strong Russian, the Russian bear. That is
right.
That is really an insult.
Yeah, bears don't have facelifts. So just in closing, and you know, how much then is the case of the Khodorkovsky in jail a litmus test for the rule of law? I mean, obviously, you know, that none of those billionaires are popular with the average Russian, but it is that the trial was pretty disgusting. What's your sense of whether that he'll ever be freed, or that you know, maybe in these next presidential elections he may make a concession to the West?
I mean, if Putin stays, he's not going to be freed, because Putin is a small man with a great revenge complex, and he's, you know, if he wanted to free Khodorkovsky, would have freed him by now, and Khodorkovsky is going to be sitting there. It's still around until 2017. So, I mean, no, there's no, I mean, and that's why Medvedev is such a disgrace, probably even more than Putin, is because he came in and said, oh, legal nihilism, we're going to amend all that. We're going to we're going to correct all that, and done nothing. And so Khodorkovsky is an embarrassment for Russia more than, I don't know, I mean, it's Nikolai Bukharin's trial probably,
sure,
of the same kind.
Well, Nina, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's professor of the Graduate School of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow of the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, the Association of Newspapers Around the World. And she serves as a deputy editor of the East European Constitutional Review at the NYU School of Law and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of a new book, The Lost Khrushchev: A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking with two activists who today tried to fight the foreclosures of a home and support the repossession of a foreclosed home by its owner.
He said, "Fear me again. No, I'm your father. Remember that no one can breathe underwater."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peggy Mears and Chase Golding, two activists involved in the Occupy Our Homes movement, which is fighting foreclosures as part of a National Day of Action. Peggy is a community organizer with ACE, Alliance for Californians for Community Empowerment, who is spearheading the movement in Riverside. And Chase is one of the organizers of Occupy LA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peggy Mears and Chase Golding.
Good evening, Ian.
And starting with you, Peggy, you were involved in an action in Riverside, California today, where the owner of a house that had been repossessed went back to reoccupy it. Apparently, it had been sitting abandoned, for 6 months? Is that right?
Yeah, 6 months.
So tell me what happened.
Basically, Mr. De Los Santos decided is that he was going to reoccupy his home. He felt that the bank had did him unjustly, which they did, and Occupy Wall Street called for a national day of homeowners reoccupying their homes all across the country. And today, all across the country, 30 families decided that they would reoccupy their homes, and he was one of the families.
Now, Peggy, are you on a speakerphone or on a regular phone?
I'm on a cell phone.
Oh, you're on a cell phone, because it sounds like a speaker.
Yeah.
That's all. There's a lot of echo.
Okay.
But, Chase, you've been with Occupy LA. Is this where, since you guys have been evicted from your tents at City Hall, is this a new stage in the movement now to start occupying foreclosed homes?
I think this is right exactly in line with our principles as a movement. I can't pretend to speak for the whole movement and whether this is a new stage. I think we have to have a lot of new pieces moving forward. But the biggest thing is that we know exactly what it feels like to be ripped from our homes, which happened to us last week in City Hall of Los Angeles. And we're now moving forward and moving outwards into the communities to connect with the 99% all over Los Angeles and all over the country. And I think this is a key piece of that strategy.
And Peggy Mears, you're in Riverside, which I understand is one of the most intense impact has been felt in that community from foreclosures and from the subprime housing bubble. Give us a flavor of because one of the great tragedies, I think, of our current period in American life is is the failure of the system, in as much as you have millions of people who have been made homeless by these greedy people on Wall Street. And at the same time, the homes that they've been evicted from are empty. So you have millions of homeless people living in the cars, and you have millions of empty homes. And if that doesn't tell you our system is broken, I don't know what does.
I agree with you. As a matter of fact, diagonally across the street from him, a house is empty that was foreclosed upon. And also, his next neighbor is facing foreclosure. So it's at epidemic proportion here in this country. And it's unfortunate because the banksters refuse to work with homeowners. This particular homeowner can more than afford a loan modification. However, the bank refuses to work with him. And we, the people, are saying that enough is enough. We're going to reoccupy our homes. We're going to stand up and fight these banksters. The American people were made to bail the bankers out. We were told, oh, they need to regroup. We need to help them out. Part of that money that they got was supposed to go to helping homeowners stay in their homes. However, what they did was they took that money and they decided to give themselves compensations and bonuses last year, which totaled over $143 billion. Something is wrong with this picture.
So tell me about the home and Art, who tried today to move back into this modest three-bedroom Inland Empire home that from which he was evicted by his bank, J.P. Morgan Chase.
Okay, well, he's in the home now. He's bought his furniture in. We have supporters from ACE, SEIU, Good Jobs Los Angeles, different organizations that decided that we're going to stand with the homeowners and fight these banksters. This is a man who has been on his job for 21 years. He also served this country in the military, and the thanks that he got was a foreclosure and kicked out of his home.
And Chase, have you been involved in this action in Riverside or the one that took place in Southgate?
Yeah, I went to both homes today. We went to Southgate and in South LA first.
Well, tell us about that. Tell us about what happened there.
That was great. I mean, just like in Riverside, a really broad coalition came together. You know, there were faith leaders, there were labor organizations, community organizations, Occupy Los Angeles, all broad swaths of society, all coming together around this issue that crosses partisan lines. A bank's going to foreclose on a Republican just as quick as they're going to foreclose on a Democrat or a Socialist or an Occupier or an SEIU member or what have you. So part of this broad coalition that we've built to move out into the communities reflects the fact that this issue cuts across any lines that they try to use to divide us as people.
So tell me about the occupant of this home that's being foreclosed on in Southgate.
Peggy probably has a better picture. I think she knows her personally.
All right. Well, let me ask Peggy. Can you answer that question, Peggy?
Well, as I said before, Art is a family man.
No, no. The one in Southgate. I was asking Chase about the house in Southgate because the occupant is still in the house.
Oh, yeah. She's still in the house. As a matter of fact, she is a young lady who has cerebral palsy. She just overcame stage 4 breast cancer. She's a fighter. She's an activist. They have 3 incomes in their family. They can more than afford a loan modification. Just like with Art De Los Santos, the banks refuse to work with them. This is common among all the banks. They refuse to work with the homeowners. It's mind-boggling because, like you said before, you have homeless, hundreds and thousands of homeless people and homes sitting up empty. These people can stay in the home and pay their loans. Why aren't the banks working with these homeowners?
And which bank is involved in the house that Anna Casas Wilson grew up in Southgate?
I believe she's dealing with Wells Fargo.
So is there any difference between any of these banks that you can tell Peggy Mears?
Only difference between the banks are their names.
I see. So, Chase, give me a sense, Chase Golding, of how you can build this movement, because here we're talking with two activists today trying to save two people in or two families in their homes, and you've got hundreds of thousands, millions of homes, and millions of homeless. There's a lot to be done.
You see this as an opportunity to build a movement. Most important is that we're physically out in these communities.
Say that. Can you repeat what you just said? We dropped out there.
Oh, I'm sorry. We absolutely see this as an opportunity to build a movement. It's very clear that.
Well, I'm afraid we're having. We keep losing you. Are you moving about, or is it just a? You probably have AT&T, right?
No, I have AT&T.
You have well. A miracle that we can hear you. So, Chase, can you?
Well, he's traveling. He's in a car.
Oh, he's in a car.
That's probably why he's dropping in and out. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's give him another shot. Chase, can you repeat what you just tried to say? You've dropped out twice.
Absolutely. I hope it's a little clearer this time.
Go ahead.
So we absolutely see this as an opportunity to build the movement moving forward. We know we have right on our side. Very clearly, the situation. We have a common sense solution. And so this is an opportunity to be out, be visible, out in these communities. And what I saw is, as soon as we got there today in Riverside, neighbors from all the surrounding homes started to come out into their lawn and these neighbors and introduce yourselves and talk about what you're doing there. They look you in the eye and they shake your hand and they thank you, because they know, number one, they could be the next victim. Number two, foreclosed vacant houses drag down property values of the entire block. And number three, they know that the country's heading in the wrong direction in this foreclosure crisis, and the bank's unwillingness to work with homeowners is a primary cause of that.
So, Peggy Mears, what's your understanding then of why it is? And I don't know this for sure, but my understanding is that very few politicians have championed the loan modifications and trying to get people to stay in their homes. And if you pointed out the two people involved, whose homes that you were trying to protect today, both have incomes and want to service their loans and stay in their homes, why is it that politicians aren't picking this up? Because this would be a winning issue, don't you think, with most people?
It's definitely a winning issue, but at this point, we the people cannot depend on any of our elected officials, Democrat or Republican, and a lot of it is the banks own the politicians. They pay for their reelection campaigns. They scare politicians. So what we've decided is that we're changing the narrative, and we're letting elected officials know that you are here to serve the people, not the banks. And if you can't and will not serve the people, we will vote you out of office and put someone in that will work for the people and not the banks.
Well, you know, we have a model, Peggy, in Springfield, Massachusetts. They have a media foreclosure ordinance in effect, where homeowners that require banks to consider, the issues of debt forgiveness. And frankly, it's even in the Bible, you know, the notion of the Jubilee.
Well, also, you don't have to go to Massachusetts. We have court mediation in Orange County where a judge, he decided that he had went to a conference and he was hearing about everything that was being done for the banks, but nothing was being done for the homeowners. He came back home to Orange County and set up mediation between the banks and the homeowners. It was a rocky start because the banks disregarded it. When they decided that, oh, you're going to disregard what we're saying, we want the president of the bank here Tuesday, or you will lose this home. So they saw that he was serious about that. They started working with the judge and the homeowners. So the court mediation program in Orange County has been really working well. We're trying to get that program in Los Angeles. It's been really hard trying to get the presiding judge to work with us. However, we have had a meeting with him since Occupy came on the scene. Occupy has opened the door and bought a lot of things, and a lot of people are finally standing up and seeing things for what they really are. So we're in solidarity with Occupy all over this country. They've really put the light on what's happening in this country. And now people are quaking in their boots because they know that there's power in numbers. And when the people stand up and fight back, they're going to lose.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Peggy, and also Chase Golding as well, both of you. I hope that this sad and counterintuitive situation is solved and all of this pain is healed. There's nothing worse than hardworking people being kicked out of their homes and still wanting to service their loans. And all these homes sitting empty as the market gets this glut of unused homes. So both of you, I thank you both.
And we thank you, Ian. I listen to your show all the time.
Well, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Peggy Mears and Chase Golding, two activists involved in the Occupy Our Homes movement, which is fighting foreclosures as part of a National Day of Action. Peggy is a community organizer with ACE, Alliance for Californians for Community Empowerment, who is spearheading the movement in Riverside, and Chase is one of the organizers of Occupy LA. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with the Harvard historian James Kloppenberg to get a sense of the historical context of President Obama's speech today in a small town in Kansas that was the site of a famous speech by Theodore Roosevelt in 1910. Clearly, President Obama is adopting a populist tone here, talking about a fair shot and a fair share, which is pretty much echoes what Teddy Roosevelt said back then. And it'll be interesting to see whether, and of course, the president did ally himself with the Occupy movement, although he did throw in the Tea Party with the Occupy movement in the sense that arguing that the American people are fed up with the disparity of wealth. But clearly, there's no two ways about it, that Teddy Roosevelt took on the big monopolies, and Kloppenberg seems to think that the president is going to certainly take a leaf out of his page, if you will, because nowadays the big monopolies and the powerful interests are defined as the 1%. And also, the historian also suggested that the current Republican Party is both a political and moral aberration, in as much as they preach the gospel of selfishness, according to Ayn Rand, which has nothing in the American tradition. And of course, the party of Lincoln, the party of Roosevelt, they're a long, long way from that in their assiduous fealty towards billionaires. Then we spoke with Nina Khrushcheva, the granddaughter of the former Soviet leader. She's just back from Moscow. She was able to talk about the Russian elections and how much the Russian people are fed up with Putin, not the young. They're being sort of brainwashed by Russian television, and they hope to get a slice of the pie in this kind of trickle-down mafia KGB state that Putin has put together. She says that part of the reason they're fed up with him is that his vanity has gotten out of hand. Apparently, he's had a facelift recently that most Russians thought was a little over the top. But he will, of course, become the next president. The elections are all but foregone conclusion, although there is a movement afoot, which we talked about, that's according to the Constitution, if you don't get 50% of the vote, the elections are null. And one of the Nemtsov, one of the liberal leaders there, is trying to organize a none of the above ticket. So we'll see where that leads and follow up on that. I think it's June, the elections for president in Russia. Then I talked with two activists who today tried to prevent the eviction of a homeowner in one home and support the reoccupation of a foreclosed home by its previous owner out here in Riverside in the so-called Inland Empire and Southgate. Peggy Mears, a community organizer with the Alliance for Californians for Community Empowerment, she spearheaded one of the actions, and Chase Golding, one of the Occupy LA organizers. We talked about what they did today and about how the Occupy movement is now going to engage more and more in occupying foreclosed homes. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also sign up and contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.